Yesterday, Jacksonville beat Buffalo 10-3, New Orleans over Carolina 31-26. And the college football national championship game tonight, Georgia and Alabama. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, January 8th. Cloudy, breezy, and seasonal. Today's high 36. Right now, a break in the cloud cover. We have some sunshine, 31 degrees. Wind from the west at 6. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Something very special is happening tonight at Carthage College, 7:30 p.m. in Wartburg Theater. It is an encore performance of a brand new play called A Seat at the Table, which received its world premiere at Carthage last March. Tonight's performance at 7:30 is free. That is, no tickets are required. The performance serves as a send-off for the cast and crew who will be performing the play later this week at the Kennedy Center Regional American College Theater Festival in Indianapolis. Carthage has been invited to this festival in 9 of the last 10 years, and this particular play is the 9th and most recent installment in Carthage's new play initiative. In honor of tonight's performance, I want to replay for you a portion of my conversation with the extraordinary woman responsible for creating this play, Regina Taylor. One of the most impressive accomplishments of the Carthage Theater Department over the last decade or so has been an ongoing project called the New Play Initiative, in which Carthage has reached out to some of the country's most acclaimed playwrights, figures like Eric Simonson, Jeffrey Hatcher, or Karadad Zvich, and established collaborative relationships with them. 8 new plays have been written expressly for the Carthage Theater Department, and the 9th new play is about to open on the stage of the Wartburg Auditorium this weekend. It's called A Seat at the Table. It is written by a very talented woman by the name of Regina Taylor, both a wonderful actress and writer. You may know her for her work in such films as Lean on Me, Courage Under Fire, Losing Isaiah, Clockers, or for her work on television on series such as The Unit or I'll Fly Away. She has the distinction of being the first black woman to play the role of Juliet on Broadway. She has ongoing relationships with the Goodman Theater of Chicago and the Signature Company in New York City. Her many plays that she has written include Magnolia, the Trinity River Plays, and the musical Crowns. This new play written for Carthage is titled A Seat at the Table, and it was inspired by the incredible story of a civil rights activist by the name of Fannie Lou Hamer. In many respects, a very ordinary woman who came out of a family of sharecroppers, but who went on to be one of the most distinctive and compelling voices of the civil rights era. Here's a portion of my conversation with its playwright, Regina Taylor. So tell us, first of all, how you first became connected with Carthage College and became aware of this opportunity. Just tell us how this collaboration began.
Martin McClendon reached out to me saying that they would like to commission me for a new piece. We met in Chicago, we talked, and I said, absolutely would be interested. I really love working with students, and I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to write specifically for a group of people.
Tell us a bit about your career and the fact that if I understand correctly, you began as a performer, as an actor, and
I've always written. I've been writing since I was a child, maybe 4 or 5 years old, writing children's books. My mother set her hand on mine, helping me to do that. It was the greatest gift that she gave me, the opportunity, the daring to create images of oneself, to take in the world and give your perspective of what you're seeing in the world, to be able to name yourself in this world. Wonderful tools for a young African-American child to have in this world. So I started out as a writer, went to school thinking I would be a journalist, and took an acting class and fell in love with that.
So in a sense, it is the reverse of how it might appear, at least on paper, or as we glance at your resume, for instance. Tell us what prompted your powerful interest in acting and what that journey was like.
It was to get an easy A, to sell out some credits for college. That's what my counselor told me. And really was wonderful for me as a very introverted person to be able to stand on stage and claim my own voice, to be able to take these journeys through different lives, different people, seeing how we're the same and how we're different, to come back from those experiences expanded as a human being, hopefully, to be able to see clearer the world and myself. To be a servant to the work as an actress. And then I started writing plays out of the acting is when I started then taking another route in terms of creating. Also then that led me to directing.
Hmm. Tell us what it was like to be writing in this new arena, that is playwriting, versus mm-hmm. the writing that you had done earlier, which I didn't know anything about until you mentioned it now, but writing children's books, not an entirely different thing, and yet in some ways quite a different artistic undertaking. Just how different were they, and how difficult was it for you to become comfortable with playwriting?
It's about, I think it's just about the technique of it. It's a different way of putting it on the page, but it's always about the story, how to capture that story. And the stories come out of questions that I have about the world, questions in the questioning, these stories, these characters take shape.
How typically have your new plays taken shape? That is, the various collaborations that you have done with places like, for instance, the Goodman Theater in Chicago that many of our listeners are well acquainted with, or the Signature Theater and other entities. I mean, typically, how do projects take shape?
Usually someone comes and says, would you like to write something for us? And usually I say yes. and then I start thinking about what I'd like to follow. I have like trunk loads of ideas already, and it's really about making the time to figure it out and put it on the page.
So typically a project begins with that open-ended an invitation. Would you write a play for us about anything,
yes,
essentially?
About anything, yes, absolutely. And then you figure out what you're passionate about, what really is on your mind. And with this, A Seat at the Table, it came out of this past year and a half, just the world turning upside down and around and back again, and then another direction. Seeing what was happening in the United States in terms of politics then led me to Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer being this absolutely amazing activist, fighter for voter rights, activist who came into the American spotlight in 1964 with the Democratic Convention when she demanded a seat at the table for herself and the delegates of the integrated delegation as opposed to the segregated delegates who were being seated by Lyndon B. Johnson. It was who has a voice, who is legitimate, and she was there front and center.
Hmm. One of the things, of course, that is so striking about the story of Fannie Lou Hamer is not just how eloquently and captivatingly she spoke in that moment and in many occasions thereafter, but also that impact was even greater when one knew her own background as the youngest of 20 children and coming out of a family of sharecroppers. Tell us more about her own life journey that led her to that momentous occasion in 1964 and all of the other work that she did.
Yes, born in Mississippi, sharecropper, 19 siblings, mother and father. She married and thought she was going to have a lot of children, and unknowingly, they sterilized her because it was the law in Mississippi at the time that you could sterilize poor African-American women without them having a say. She came into the civil rights movement when people were registering people to vote. She didn't know she had that right until then. She then tried registering to vote, did not pass the test that was required. There's a test and a tax you had to pay, but it was, you had to, sometimes it was to explain the Constitution, understand its meaning, to be able to write it, to read it, and to explain the Constitution. Might be a test before you would pay and then be able to vote. She didn't pass that test the first time, and when she went back to the plantation where she lived, the owner of the plantation told her she would need to stop doing this or she would have to leave her home 18 years. She refused to back down, and she had to leave her family behind, her husband and her two adopted children, because she refused to not give up her dream to vote. She was embraced by SNCC, putting her front and center at a lot of the meetings as a kind of piper, for people to sign on, someone like her, grassroots, putting their lives on the line to vote. It was then that they started forming, they had the idea to form a group that would register people outside of the Jim Crow segregated system. And create their own party, and register as many African Americans as possible. But around that time, Mississippi was almost half African-American. So if they got enough people to vote, they could have their own mayor, governor, et cetera. So this was very empowering because they knew the numbers were great enough. If they stuck together, then they would be in a powerful position for either party, either the Democrats or the Republicans, because at that time the nation was split down the middle, and they could then tip the scales. They would be a very powerful entity. They then put that delegation together, went to Atlantic City, where the convention was being held, and told Lyndon B. Johnson, we should be seated instead of the Mississippi segregated delegates. And LBJ was in a spot because he didn't want to lose the South by seeming to cater to African Americans. That's where the story is. It begins is that 1964 convention.
So a seat at the table tells us about that particular moment in Mrs. Hamer's life.
It begins there, and then we go back to her very humble beginnings to see how she got there. In 1964, it would seem that she did not win that quest of having integrated delegates. And I like the story having to deal with that. How do you deal with what seems to be a loss? What have you gained? And how do you continue on in that next time, the next convention, she is seated.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Regina Taylor, responsible for a brand new play about to open at Carthage College called A Seat at the Table, inspired by the story of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. And it focuses in particular on that dramatic moment during the 1964 Democratic convention. Explain to our listeners that maddening decision that then-President Lyndon Baines Johnson did that, in effect, not exactly silenced Fannie Lou Hamer, but deprived the wider American public from being able to watch her as she testified. Explain what he did and what kind of impact you think that had.
Yes, the delegates had to present their case to be recognized and to be seated during that convention. It was the segregated party or the desegregated party. Fannie Lou Hamer's delegates, who should be seated. So they had to testify. There were several people that testified, including Martin Luther King and including Fannie Lou Hamer. It seems that Lyndon B. Johnson was more afraid of Fannie Lou Hamer speaking than Martin Luther King Jr. Speaking, Dr. Martin Luther King, that when they were presented to testify broadcast live to the nation, Lyndon B. Johnson interrupted the broadcast when Fannie Lou Hamer got up to speak, and he interrupted it for this special announcement, and they thought he was going to announce who his running mate was going to be. Instead, he announced the 9-month anniversary of Connally being shot along with JFK. And they went, well, that's not a reason to interrupt a broadcast. Why? Became the question. And the answer was, he did want to silence her, and that became the story. So they rebroadcast her that evening on the evening news, And that's how so many people got to know her, got to know her story.
Can you just say a word about what she was like as a communicator? I suspect quite a few of our listeners, but I suspect not all of our listeners, have seen the footage of this extraordinary testimony which she delivers in 1964. I still remember what a powerful impact it had on me when I watched it on the documentary series Eyes on the Prize.
Yeah.
But for someone who does not know the face and the voice and the inflection of Fannie Lou Hamer, just say a word about her really powerful eloquence.
She was a powerhouse. She was called the voice of the civil rights movement. She would be on these marches, and she would share her songs. These were spirituals that had been converted into protest songs. She was a powerful speaker. Her testimony was raw. It was real. It came from the soil of the Mississippi Delta. She told the story of her life in a really impactful way. She was very loud. Everyone said she was very loud, was very distinctive, but she was very truthful, honest. And what she talked about, and just in terms of wanting to be a full, whole citizen of these United States of America, with the right to vote, to have your voice up in there, deciding who should represent, and the power that that brings to self and communities was very strong. As an African-American woman in the times that she lived in, what she did is staggering, putting her life on the line. And it was. At one point, she was taken into jail because she was registering people to vote, and they beat her within an inch of her life. She could barely move. Once she finally got out of that jail, had several months to recover from that beating, and she got back up, and she kept marching, and she kept telling her truth.
I don't know if we have yet talked about one of the most disturbing moments in Fannie Lou Hamer's life, which occurs several years before her dramatic appearance at the Democratic National Convention. And I think it so vividly speaks to the times in which she lived and the degradation that was so often a part of poor African Americans living in the South. I'm speaking of what happened as she had surgery done in 1961. And had something done to her at the time without her consent by her white doctor. Can you say a word about that? And I'm curious also if this is mentioned at all in A Seat at the Table.
Oh, yes, absolutely. When she sterilized without her consent, because it was law in Mississippi to, you had the right to sterilize poor African-American women. They had no say.
It really says something. I mean, for somebody living in America now, who looking back over that chasm of time, who might not really fully understand what it meant to be a black in Mississippi in 1961, it seems to me that what Fannie Lou Hamer suffered, this indignity at this moment in her life, capsulizes as much as any single moment can just
yes,
what that era
no
talks.
Right. You have no rights in terms of your own body. It is a time of Jim Crow laws. It is a time where African Americans are not seen as fully human and with the full rights of American citizens. It is a time when people are standing up and placing their lives on the line to make a change. It is a time when the nation is divided down the middle. Who are we going to vote for to represent our ideas of which way this democracy should go? It is a time that feels all too familiar at this moment in time. And that's why I was very excited to write it and to share it with the students, one, who do not know this history. And as they are looking at which way they might go in this political climate, it's important that we do know this history as we're trying to steer our direction forward.
I know you have been to Carthage at least a couple of times since agreeing to create this new play for the Carthage Theater Department. Tell us about the visits that you have paid to the campus and the personal connection that you have forged, at least to some extent, with the young people who are in your cast.
Yes, it's been really interesting to me working with the students who are learning this history for the first time. They play a range. Each student plays a range of characters, both older and young, from someone playing a brother to Fannie Lou Hamer to playing Medgar Evers to playing someone that works for Martin Luther King to different ages, and it is a multicultural cast because we think of black and white issues and we don't look around to beyond black and white. One student, it was very interesting, he was saying that because we also deal with the slaying of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman during Freedom Summer, who were freedom riders on the bus taken and killed that summer. So one of the young men was saying, this guy is my age. And they chose to take their summer to take this ride on the bus, knowing that they could be killed. And they did that for what they believed in. And he questioned, well, would I do that? He had to question himself. It is about a questioning of what Fannie Lou Hamer did, was she questioned America. She dared to question America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, this place that she loved and knew that she was willing to stand up, speak, dare, lay her life on the line for implementing some changes that needed to happen. So the students are looking at that. It is, this play has music of the period, protest music from Sam Cooke, to Bob Dylan. It is a piece about resistance. It is a piece about questioning who you are in this moment of 1964, but also questioning who we are at this moment in time.
Regina Taylor is the extraordinary woman who wrote this new play called A Seat at the Table, which received its world premiere at Carthage back in March and receives an encore performance tonight at 7:30 p.m. in Wartburg Theater. Admission is free. No tickets are required. The play will then be presented later this week at the Kennedy Center's Regional American College Theater Festival in Indianapolis. The production is directed by Martin McClendon, musical direction by Dmitry Shapovalov. We wish all of them well. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. It's always a great pleasure to be able to return to a talented author after I've had an interesting interview with them. A couple of years ago, I had the great pleasure of speaking with best-selling author Tom Clavin about a riveting book of his called Last Men Out, which talks about the desperate final hours of the last American military men who were in Saigon as it fell. And that book is incredible, and it was a great pleasure to speak with Tom Clavin. And now we speak with Tom Clavin once again about his most recent book, which is called Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bette Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the American West. So we're talking about a very different place, but in some respects we are also talking about a city consumed by chaos. And, of course, in the case of this particular story, we are talking about some famous men who did a great deal to try to bring law and order into this wild, chaotic small city of chaos on the edge of the American frontier. And it's also a story that in some respects is well known to many Americans, but probably you know the story more through the lens of fanciful fiction rather than the cold hard facts. And Tom Clavin has worked really hard to separate fact from fiction. And in doing so, he's written a book that nevertheless is incredibly dramatic and exciting. Again, it's titled Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bette Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the American West, published by St. Martin's Press. Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. And it's interesting you make that connection between Saigon on April 30th, 1975, and the original Dodge City in Kansas in the 1870s, because, you know, we all know there's a familiar expression that's, you know, come down to the present day. When somebody says, I had to get out of Dodge, we immediately know what they were talking about. They had to get out of a bad situation. They had to get out of a chaotic environment. And certainly that was Saigon when it was falling. And that all stems from what Dodge City was, what it represented, not just in its immediate surroundings, but even you look back at what the newspapers were reporting in Philadelphia and New York, and you know, they were calling Dodge City the wickedest place in the West, and it was a place that became known for, like you say, chaos.
Right. Briefly, I wish we had more time to talk about this. I want to return to a point I was making in the introduction, and which you explore in your author's note, namely the fact that there is so much fiction, so much legend, so much myth that has sprung up around Dodge City, and particularly around figures like Wyatt Earp and Bette Masterson. You say at one point, over the years, tall tales have stuck to them like barnacles on a boat. And for you, the challenge was, in a sense, to try to separate fact from fiction, to try to figure out, to whatever extent we can, exactly what happened. And, of course, at the same time, create an exciting book, which, of course, you have. But talk for a moment about the challenge of trying to figure out where the line is between fact and fiction when it comes to these legendary figures from the Old West.
Well, that was one of the concerns, I think, that not only that I had, but I guess my editor had, is that, okay, you want to, that's understandable that you don't want to publish a book that is filled with half-truths and lies and fabrications and embellishments. But if you take all that stuff out, do you have a story left? And that's turned out to be what was a big part of the fun of working on the book, because when you do sort of separate the mythical stuff, I mean, for example, Bette Masterson, in his later years, he was often referred to as bloodthirsty Bat, and he had the blood of 26 outlaws on his hands from all the outlaws he killed, and that's not true. However, the truth is that Bat had a very adventurous, fascinating, long for the time life. which included, you know, encountering many people, that, and it's all in the book, you know, the James brothers. He became friends with Frank and Jesse James, and there's Billy the Kid. There's Theodore Roosevelt he became friends with, and that became important to him later in his life. And the same thing with Wyatt Earp. We have, especially from Hollywood, we have these films in which Wyatt Earp is portrayed and as mostly in Tombstone Wyatt Earp, and all the myths and legends surrounding Wyatt Earp, also as a hard-drinking gunfighter, he and Doc Holliday. And you find out that Wyatt Earp, not that he could not use a gun and that he wasn't a really good lawman, but he was a different character altogether. He was a peace officer, and he was his job, and he talks about this when he was hired at Dodge City. He said, "My job is not to kill more people. We have enough being killed. My job is to stop the killing." And so, they did form posses. They did chase outlaws. They did have confrontations in the streets of Dodge. A lot of that is still true, and I think that knowing you can read something that's exciting and it's true is like a double benefit.
Absolutely. We should talk about Dodge City itself, and before we talk about how it became such a wicked place and chaotic place, talk briefly about why it sprang into being in the first place and why it had such prominence. There are several different factors that you cite in terms of why Dodge City ended up being the keystone of the frontier.
Well, it originally began because Fort Dodge, which was an Army outpost, the commander there was having a problem with the soldiers and even some of his officers drinking on duty. And so he banned alcohol from the fort. And Fort Dodge began as a couple of sod houses that were bars, saloons, early saloons. The idea being, okay, the soldiers couldn't drink at the fort. Well, then they can travel the 5 or 6 miles to where we're going to put together these few little sod houses and supply whiskey and a piano, let's say, to entertain the troops. And gradually other places opened up. It became a little settlement. But what really made Dodge take off was that where it was situated, it was right in the path of where the railroad was working its way west towards Colorado. So once the railroad arrived in Dodge City, which was in 1872, the city took off because it became a gravitational point for all these ranchers from Texas and their cowboy employees to have these long cattle drives and bring thousands and tens of thousands of cattle up to Dodge City where they could be sold and loaded onto the railroad and taken to Chicago and other slaughterhouses elsewhere. And then when you paid off your cowboys, they suddenly had these pockets full of cash. And they wanted to party. They wanted alcohol to drink. They wanted various forms of entertainment. And the city sort of exploded with saloons and bordellos and other places that would supply the various entertainments. And it grew so much faster than any kind of law and order could keep track. So that's why, there's a story in the book, an anecdote in the book about a fellow's on a train heading west, and the conductor sees, like, he looks pretty down in the dumps, and he says, "Where are you going, buddy?" And the guy says, "I'm going to hell." And the conductor says, "That's $2 and get off at Dodge City." You know, that was the reputation it acquired, and it became a reputation where some people were afraid not only to live there, but afraid to go there, even pass through it. So a big reason why people like Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson were hired was to not to outshoot the bad guys, not to outshoot the cowboys, but you got to find ways to keep the peace here, because otherwise this is going to become a ghost town after a while. If nobody wants to live here, they're too frightened.
Right. And I'm so glad that you kind of point this out, the fact that its own success, in a sense, was its own worst enemy. The way you put it is, with such an abrupt transition of the town from watering hole to a center of Kansas commerce, is it its administration, such as it was not ready for the overwhelming influx of buffalo hunters who would be followed by cowboys who had just spent anywhere from 30 to 100 days on sunburnt, fly-infested trails and had pay in their pockets. There was no police force when things got out of hand. The nearest law enforcement was 75 miles to the north. And
right.
So it's little wonder that Dodge City took on the character that it is, and of course other places on the frontier did as well, but in a sense Dodge City was the most notorious.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that happens then in Dodge City is because of this serious situation, there is, in a sense, the attempt to implement some kind of law and order, which it was thought might serve as sort of a blueprint for similar communities in the Old West. This literally where it began, in a sense?
It did. I mean, there had been attempts in Abilene and Wichita and Fort Hays and some other places in Kansas. Now, Kansas was the frontier. You know, people today might not consider Kansas the American West and the American Western frontier, but it was in the 1860s and 1870s, the post-Civil War period. And so Dodge City became the most famous of what they called the cowtowns. And so what happened in Dodge City was going to be imitated elsewhere. And a lot of the business leaders, the people who had first opened their saloons and other businesses in Dodge City, and were overjoyed when the railroad came, and were overjoyed when, you know, cowboys by the hundreds were going through town and drinking, and just, you know, the cowboy would be paid off at the end of a trail drive, and he'd be there for a week and be broke again. He had to go back on another trail drive. So initially they were overjoyed because all this money was coming in and the economy was going great, but they started to realize when people are shooting each other in the street, when you can't bury them at Boot Hill fast, they're dying faster than you can bury them on Boot Hill, that things were definitely out of hand, and everybody was at risk.
Right.
And so that's why, just like you say, when these young lawmen, and I have to emphasize that Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson were only in their 20s, these were not guys that had gone through Sheriff's Academy. They were young guys. They sort of had to try and figure it out as they went along with their badges on. And what they started to do in Dodge City, a way they found ways to tame the chaos in Dodge City, was a blueprint for the rest of the American frontier.
One of the keys to their approach, as you've already talked about, was that they were not about the business of just sort of wildly trying to shoot. And in some respects, a cautionary tale is something that was attempted just before them, group called the Society of Vigilantes.
Mm-hmm.
It was an ill-fated effort, and right. And in some ways, what Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson did was so much better.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, as you can imagine, the vigilante approach didn't work, and it just caused more chaos. And then they did hire a fellow, a marshal named Bully Brooks, and, you know, the name says a lot, because his approach was to shoot them faster than he could be shot. And in the first few months, he killed a dozen men. So this wasn't going to work either. And that's where a new administration came in and a new marshal of Dodge City, and he hired Wyatt Earp as an assistant marshal. And Wyatt was the one, basically, was the one going to patrol the streets and implement it. And, yes, they couldn't resolve the problem and the violence and the wildness that was going on in the streets by shooting more people. The idea was, we have to arrest them and then, you know, put them before a judge. Let's get some kind of law and order and justice system in this town. Otherwise, it's just going to be a place that people are going to abandon. And the frontier, you know, by extension, the frontier will just remain a lawless place. So another reason was economic. You know, marshals, sheriffs, deputies, they didn't get paid that much, but they could supplement their salary by being paid $2.50 per arrest. So if you could subdue a guy and get him into jail and put him before a judge the next morning, you would get your $2.50. If you killed him, no money. So it wasn't a good idea from a salary point of view to actually shoot and kill a guy because you wouldn't get paid for it.
As you've already said, neither Wyatt Earp nor Bat Masterson went through any kind of extensive training as we would envision today. What were sort of the natural gifts that each of them brought to this daunting task?
Well, in the case of Wyatt, he was 6 feet tall. He was 6 feet tall, which at that time was a taller man than the average, and he had a method called buffaloing, in which if he was a confrontation with somebody, he would take out his gun, not to shoot him, but bash him over the top of the head and knock him out. He'd haul him off to jail, and next morning he'd go before the judge with a headache. He also was a man of really strong personal courage, and eventually he was a man of pretty significant integrity, and he didn't start out that way. One of the things the books talk about is that he was a horse thief. He had a lot of trouble with the law before he started to turn his life around. So Wyatt had a quiet intensity and sense of purpose that sort of radiated off him. Now, Bat Masterson was more of a happy-go-lucky, jovial kind of guy. One of the things Bat brought to him was he was very intelligent, he had a very strong constitution, and he also had a very strong sense of what was right and wrong. And so when Bat became, Bat was only 22 years old when he was elected sheriff of Ford County, which in which Dodge City resides. And, you know, it would be very easy for somebody that young to just, you know, dismiss his responsibilities or, you know, not even bother. But he took them very seriously. And so the two of them, who became best friends, we had the combination of Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, having each other's back and patrolling the streets of Dodge City, was a wake-up call to the entire community that, hey, you know, Dodge City is a place where law and order can prevail. It's a place where we can build schools and build churches and people can raise their families. And that was an enormous transition that was going on in the 1870s.
Right. And, of course, you end up telling us story after story after story about their incredible exploits and the amazing array of characters who come to town.
Yes.
We have about a minute left if you want to entice our listeners with one quick story that you find especially intriguing.
Well, there was an outlaw named Clay Allison that came to Dodge City, and he came there to kill Wyatt Earp, and he was going to get revenge for what he perceived as a death of a friend of his. And when he confronted Wyatt Earp, he also had a couple of cowboys stashed in a doorway, and the idea was when the shooting started, you know, he would get help from them from behind. And Wyatt Earp confronted him, and this guy, Clay Allison, took the measure of Wyatt Earp and said, you know what, I don't think I'm going to have a gunfight today. And he called to the guys in the doorway, okay, fellas, put your guns down. And another voice rang out and said, that's right, fellas, put your guns down. They turned around, and there was Bat Masterson behind him with a shotgun aimed at them. So that was a perfect example of how these guys had each other's back and how they no matter how bad a guy was, bad an outlaw was, he was up against the best that the law could provide in Dodge City with Bat and Wyatt.
The book is amazing, and again, it's called Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and the Wickedest Town in the American West, published by St. Martin's Press and the author Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, I enjoyed your book so much, and I'm glad we had this conversation about it. Very best wishes to you.
Me too. Thanks very much.
And this was yet another encore broadcast from 2017, one of our favorite morning show interviews of last year. And again, in part one of today's program, we heard from Regina Taylor, the playwright responsible for A Seat at the Table, which receives an encore performance at Carthage tonight at 7:30, free and open to the public. We have brand new interviews for the next several days on the morning show. Tomorrow, you're going to be hearing from John Maggio, director of an amazing documentary airing on the PBS series American Experience called Into the Amazon, which tells the harrowing story of the journey into the Amazon rainforest undertaken by a small group of Americans, including then former U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt. It was a dangerous journey, and Roosevelt was almost killed. On Wednesday, I speak with documentarian Susan Fromke about her wonderful film called The Opera House, which tells the story of the design and construction of what was known as the New Met when it first opened in 1966, a new home for the Metropolitan Opera, which had been in existence since 1883. It is a complex and fascinating story, and one does not even need to be an opera fan to find the story quite compelling. I speak with Susan Fromke on Wednesday. This is going to be the next high-definition simulcast from the Metropolitan Opera in movie theaters across the country. On Thursday, you'll hear from Michael Klickner, the director of the Racine Theater Guild's production of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, a Tony Award-winning play, a delightful play I was privileged to see on Broadway. And I'm excited to speak with Michael Klickner about the Theater Guild's production of it. And on Friday, then, with yet another encore of one of our favorite morning show interviews from 2017, you'll hear my conversation with Captain James Hawkins, a commanding officer of the Great Lakes Naval Base, and someone who was born and raised right here in Kenosha. Captain Hawkins joined me live in the studio a couple of days after I had the privilege of experiencing an extensive tour of the Great Lakes Naval Base, an absolutely amazing facility. And it was an honor for me to speak with Captain Hawkins all about it. That's coming up on Friday's